This is Charlottesville Tomorrow. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonprofit organization engaging the public on critical quality of life issues so we make informed choices for our community's future. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org. On November 3, 2015, voters in the Ravana Magisterial District go to the polls to elect their representative on the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors. This recording is Brian Wheeler's September 1, 2015 interview with Republican candidate Richard Lloyd. The other candidates in the race are Democrat Norman Dill and Independent Lawrence Gaughan. Mr. Lloyd, thank you for participating in this interview with Charlottesville Tomorrow. The complete audio recording and written transcript for this interview will be available online. Information from this interview will be used in the compilation of the Nonpartisan Voter Guide, being co-produced by Charlottesville Tomorrow, The Daily Progress, and the League of Women Voters. Charlottesville Tomorrow does not endorse any candidates, and our goal is to provide information to the public so they can make an informed vote on issues primarily related to land use, transportation, public education, and community design. As you are aware, the first two questions you will be asked have been provided in advance. For the others, you have been provided only the topics in advance. All Albemarle Supervisor candidates will be asked the same questions. We ask that you keep these questions confidential until all candidates have been interviewed. Each candidate will be provided an opportunity to review the excerpts selected for the voter guide before its publication. Are you ready to start?
The available online, and that's to the community or to just me or you or whom?
To everybody. Yep, it'll be on the website.
For the community.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're on air right now.
That's right. This podcast will be available. Yep.
Okay.
Question number one. Please describe your past experience that qualifies you to be on the Albemarle Board of Supervisors.
Well, with the proviso that we were supposed to review these questions before, I have to be speaking off the cuff because we weren't aware of that. But anyway, qualifications. I've been born in Albemarle County. I went to Virginia schools, went to Virginia Tech where I received a civil mechanical engineering degrees, graduated in 1975. I've worked for Fortune 500 and Fortune 100 companies right out of college, I worked with some of the best people in their fields on the planet. I worked with Ingersoll Rand and was selected to be in their six-pack program, which were six of us in the $4 billion company that went to all of the divisions. Manufacturing facilities and worked in their marketing departments and in their engineering departments and was passed by all five plants and was one of the six that graduated from that. As such, I've worked with major companies and small companies. I have been responsible for receiving huge orders from Fortune 500 companies. I've worked with the vice presidential level of many large Fortune 100 companies. And I think that gives me the ability to discern what are the important points, to hear the questions I don't understand but know where to go to get the answers, and to stand the wind against people who will not listen to my point of view. I don't expect everybody to agree with it, but I do hope that they will listen to the point of view and consider it.
Question number two. What is your top priority for action by the Board of Supervisors if you're elected?
Well, I think the top priority, of course, is to maintain a bipartisan Board of Supervisors. If the Board of Supervisors currently is made of six seats, five of those seats are held by a very liberal group, and one seat is held by a very conservative individual who's retiring. That's the seat that I'm running for. I think it's important that the Board of Supervisors have a bipartisan attitude so that they can deal with the needs of all of the citizens of the county. To go in all on one frame of reference or all on one perspective, you lose the ability to discuss issues from both sides, and invariably you'll lose and create more controversies than lose contingencies, and you'll create more controversies than if you had the controversy before the decisions were made. So I look to have some kind of balance there. I look to have visibility of what's going on the board from the conservative perspective. And offer some pushback when it's appropriate. We can't have paralysis by consensus. I'm not looking for paralysis by consensus, but I am looking for both sides of the debates to be represented and to have a reasonable debate before decisions are made. I think that's number one priority on the board. Second priority, of course, is to contain our taxes, our cost of living. You know, when we raise the cost of living, we push people over the edge. They can't afford it anymore. And where do those people go? They either go to surrounding counties or they go on social services. If they go to the surrounding counties, who are they? Well, a lot of them are our police force. A lot of them are our hospital workers, our teachers, the auto mechanics, and so forth. I ask the people that I encounter day by day, where do you live? And that class of people live predominantly in the surrounding counties. Now take the police officer, for instance. Every nickel that we pay that man to do his job ends up going into the economy of the surrounding counties, not into our economy. It's a complete outflow from our economy and a complete inflow into the others. Plus, he becomes a mercenary. He comes here to work, and then he goes home to his society or his community. So I'd like for my children to go to school with the police officer's children. I'd like for my wife to go shopping with the police officer, and I'd like to go to church with his wife, and I'd like to go to church with the officer himself. That, to me, builds community. And to drive these people out of our community destroys community. We talk about police officers encountering people on the main mall, but they're not people that they live with. That's a city problem. I know the main mall is a city pedestrian mall, but it happens in the county also. So that's a priority. Somehow we have to contain our cost of living, and the biggest portion of that is containable is the budget, is the tax rate. So they're the top two that I would go after. There are many, many other issues that come up and have come up. Some of them are resolved, some are not resolved, and some of them we don't even know about yet. But we'll have to work as a board to hear them out, air them out, see what the unintended consequences are, and make decisions from an informed perspective.
Question number three, speaking of the budget. Name one specific area of the county budget that you are concerned about and tell us why.
The process, the budgetary process. When you look at a multi-billion dollar company in the budget, even of a division, you're looking at a very complex document it's larger than the state than the county of Albemarle. The way we could get our hands around it is that we had fixed expenses and discretionary expenses. So the fixed expenses are things that you can't change. We've got to pay our taxes. What are the taxes? We don't need to discuss it. They are what they are, and the corporation's not going to be able to change them. Yes, there are tax attorneys there. Yes, they are trying to. But from a board perspective, you can't do anything about it. You've got to pay it. But they're discretionary items. Should we go into this business? Should we go into work on this profit center? So we got the fixed and the discretionary. But in Albemarle County, we look at the budget by line items. And nobody knows, here's the school budget. The school budget is 60% of the entire budget. But what portion of the school budget is fixed? And if we can take that and move it aside and then look at the increment that's discretionary, we can start to prioritize these discretionary items. We can start to look at them one by one by one because they're manageable. You can get your hands around them. You can see them, and you can anticipate the unintended consequences of making these decisions. But to take them on their whole and try to deal with them, to me, obfuscates the entire line item. It's too complex. It's too laborious. Staff can do a great job of saying, this is fixed. This is discretionary. Let's negotiate the discretionary and find out what we want to do as a board. Then we give the budget to the back to the school board, and then they can massage it again. But they only have to look at the discretionary items, and then the staff will take care of the fixed items. And say we're paying too high a rent on a particular building or whatever, they can take that issue up without having to bring it to the board level.
Question number four.
Business leaders and social service agencies have told local government that new investments are sorely needed in the area of early childhood education. Will you make pre-K education and quality child care a priority, and if so, how?
You know, I was born in Greenwood. I had to go to the hospital in Richmond for a pleuric stenosis, but my parents lived in Greenwood. And they got divorced. And I went to live with my mother and my grandparents. They provided the childhood education. And I had one of the best childhoods and best childhood educations possible. And I believe that we need to support the families to pick up as much of the load as they can, because that not only instills family values, but it also is the most tender, concerned, loving situation you can have for pre-K care and education. A lot of it's care. It's just not education. It's to get them socially ready for kindergarten and first grade. But there are people who, through disabilities or they're the disadvantaged people that don't get that. It isn't available. It can't be had. They have no family around them, or they have physical or mental disabilities that exceed the capacity of the family. And I think that's where government has to step in and help. And education is what I have often referred to as a magical enabler. Education enables people to go on and live their lives in a very productive manner. And a lack of education is a disabler. And this early childhood education is the beginning of it all. So we've got these programs that are out there. We've got Title I. We've got Bright Stars. We've got, what do they call that, Ready to Learn, or it's a readiness program. It's really well run. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of it. We've got all kinds of social programs, but they overlap. Are they being properly coordinated? Who's responsible for coordinating them? Is it the teacher in the classroom? Because she's already got her goals set out to educate the children, not prepare for this. So I think that we need to make sure that people going in know who they can go to for coordination of all of these service programs, and what the programs are good at and doing and accomplishing, and what their targets are, and does this child fit those targets, and is he in the right program, or should he be in all the programs, or one of them, or two of them. It's just an outpouring of aid, but aid without some organization behind it becomes very complex, especially for people who are just entering our society and don't even speak the language. So early childhood education is fundamental, and I hope that the families are encouraged and supported in giving it themselves, and where they can't, we need a very good coordinated system to pick up the slack.
Question number 5. How should Albemarle County fund water resource programs to clean up local streams and comply with state mandates for protection of the Chesapeake Bay watershed? And a follow-up, would you support creation of a stormwater utility fee similar to the one enacted by the city of Charlottesville, which is based on the amount of impervious surface on a property?
That's almost a political question beyond a stormwater question. You know, 13 states were just, the EPA was sued by 13 states over their TMDLs, and a federal judge put a stay on the EPA saying that these 13 states, and Virginia wasn't, can't be classed as, they took the waters of the navigable waters of the United States and took the word navigable out and called it the waters of the United States, and they were trying to regulate the streams and the farm ponds and even the seasonal streams on people's properties, giving them the right to come on their property and inspect and make their recommendations and enact fines on them. Well, the federal court just said it's an injunction. They can't do that, and it'll go to court and be litigated. Virginia's not one of the 13 states. So we've got this problem that, what is the power of the EPA? Will the suit, the injunction, be taken to a national level, or will it stay with those 13 states? But it shows that there is an overreach within the EPA, an overreach that the federal court has addressed at least is beginning to address. The TMDLs bother me because they say, here is the TMDL that we're looking for, the total daily, total maximum daily load. And they're looking at only three pollutants, which is kind of a problem in itself because there are many pollutants that are not in the TMDLs that are very, very toxic. I grew up sailing on the Chesapeake Bay with my uncles, and we sailed almost every weekend, almost every summer. And I've sailed a lot since then, recently. And I love the Chesapeake Bay. And I have seen, you know, when we were kids, we could jump off a dock and our feet would hit the sand bottom. And the crabs were all over the pilings. And we had a blast. I could go down and feed myself off of the crabs on the piling. They're not there anymore. When I jump off the dock, I don't go to the sand bottom, I go to muck. So what is the muck? You get buckets of it and pull it up, and I've looked at them and looked at them. I've had people that I know that are far more capable than I look at them. And the muck is coming from the algae, the algae blooms. And where is the algae bloom happening? It was happening everywhere. And it's largely because of the runoff of the fields. Our own fields at the farm are fertilized. It rains, and before the fertilizer can sink in, it runs into the Chesapeake Bay, and the algae starts. And the muck is created when the algae dies in the winter, year after year after year. So there are problems there. The TMDLs that we're looking at up here in Albemarle are inconsequential compared to some of the things that I've seen happen close up on the bay itself. And we don't have, they say, here's the TMDL product, target. Well, in the spring in Albemarle, as most of the people who have lived here for a while know, we have large rains. And the large rains come down in the mountains and they purge the mountains. The mountains have, through the freeze and the snows and the winter, the organics, the leaves and the branches and so forth rot, and they stain the water very dark. And then there are more deer in Albemarle County than there are humans. I haven't seen a deer on the toilet yet. And in the spring, all that fecal material is purged out of the forest, and it goes into the streams and rivers, and it ends up concentrating itself in the South Fork Reservoir. It's a good place to witness it. In fact, Ravana Water and Sewer puts out warnings. Do not let your dog swim or drink the water. I mean, that's pretty putrid water. And the nutrient level is going through the roof, sky high. And then all of that purges itself and it goes downstream. It floods the floodplains. It fertilizes them. The farmers, during a drought, take their cattle to the floodplains because that's where it's green, the fertilizer. We've got to let the floodplains flood. Plus, they retain a lot of that water. They turn into sponges. So when we have a drought, the sponges drain and support the rivers and the streams and the creeks. But if we don't let them flood, then they don't get the nutrients, and they also don't get the recharge of the water. So when we have a drought, we have a terrible time with the drought. It's floodplain management, and the floodplain management practices that I was taught back in school were entirely different from the floodplain managers that are coming out of management's coming out of Ravana Water and Sewer. We have a drought, and you'll see people just go nuts. And it's, I mean, not a drought, a flood, and it's a natural occurrence. So all that happens, and then we get into the summer, and the rains kind of get more moderate, and the waters clear up, and the Ravana, the South Fork Reservoir becomes very pleasant again. But you have to realize that the nutrient level is going up and down, up and down. And then that's just seasonal. And then year by year, sometimes we have huge rains and sometimes we just have large rains. And so these nutrient levels are going all over the place. What is normal? We can't establish a normal level for our rivers and streams until we get to the Chesapeake Bay. And at the Chesapeake Bay, the James River comes across Lynn Haven and goes to sea. The prevailing flow of the Chesapeake Bay is southward. It doesn't go north. It doesn't get up to the Rappahannock. It doesn't get to the York River. It can't. It's the Susquehanna and the Potomac and the Rappahannock and the York, and they're all going south. So whatever we do is really affecting Lynn Haven, which happens to be seeing a resurgence in the crabs and oysters right now. So I think we need to get some reality. You know, they say we want to have normalcy. Well, what is normal? And then Albemarle County says they want to go beyond that. Well, how do you get more normal than normal? I mean, you can make them extremely low, but just think of the cost of trying to upgrade an entire watershed. I mean, we haven't got enough money to do that. So there needs to be some real thought given to this. And I don't know that even, you know, they say we can look at the critters in the river, the what's alive, and look for, we studied that back in school too. Well, some of these have natural patterns to their population growth and their death and so forth. Right now, if you look at the last thing that came out from, not the DEQ, but who's the local, the environmental people locally, on how to pay for the stormwater, they have a map, and it shows the impaired waters, the impaired streams. North Fork of the Mormons River has no development on it. There's not anything on it, and it's shown to be impaired. I don't understand that. I'd like to know more data behind it, and quite frankly, running as a political candidate, the door-to-door knocking is keeping me from doing the research that I'd like to do in that area. But we'll get there. We'll get that all under control and investigated. The follow-up here was what?
Would you support the creation of a stormwater utility fee?
Oh, now we're getting into the continual battle between the development areas and the farms. Now, who's going to pay whatever these fees are? I think right now we've got a $1.8 million fee that we're paying annually to the state. You know, the way it works is the EPA gave a license to the federal government. The federal government gave licenses to the states. And the states have come out and said, here are the normal numbers that we want to attain, and you can either adopt those or you can go beyond them. And Albemarle County has decided they're going to go way beyond them. And I think all of that is yet to be completely solidified or codified. And I hope that they consider, you know, what's more normal than normal, and how do you arrive at normalcy. But will that burden fall upon the development areas, which are houses and schools and hospitals and gas stations and churches and all of that, or will it fall upon the rural areas? Because one of the biggest creators of nitrogen and phosphorus in the water are the forest. So, you know, how do we sort this out? Who's going to pay the freight? If the current law is an establishment, is a codified, then you can go onto a farmer's land and say your farm pond is polluted. Fix it. Well, quite frankly, have you ever swam in a farm pond? They're nasty. It's the lowest place on the farm. Everything drains to the farm pond. They say don't let the cows in the river, but that means it drains somewhere else. So I don't want to swim in a farm pond, but if you're going to look at the farm pond and say that's the standard, clean it up, you just put the farmer out of business. I mean, we need the farmers. We don't need to put these obstacles on them, especially when they're based in questionable determinations. So who's going to pay for them? Well, that's going to be a hard one, because is it a real requirement or is it a fictitious requirement to start with? All of that on top of the fact that I want to see the Chesapeake Bay get back to where it was when I was a child. So we have to do something. One of the biggest culprits I see is that I see oils floating on the water from time to time. It is a shipping channel, but there's an awful lot of water coming down the Susquehanna, oil and pollutants coming down the Susquehanna River. And there are an awful lot of factories on the Susquehanna. Ingalls Iran closed one in Phillipsburg years ago. We couldn't sell the land because it was so polluted, and they still own the land. Well, no, they don't, because Ingersoll Rand is now a Bermudian company. All right, that's enough for stormwater. We can go on for hours on that. It's something that I'm passionate about.
Great. Question number 6. In the remainder of 2015, or during your first term if you are elected, should the board make boundary adjustments for Albemarle County's designated growth areas to create new locations for business on land that today is in the rural area? Why or why not?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why do we need growth areas? You know, what's the purpose of a growth area? I think everybody agrees we need them. Why do we need business development? I mean, why do we need any business at all? Some people in the community say, and I think it was Foley, the executive for the county, who said that we had 5 acres of developable area. And other people say, I think the Sierra Club said, we have hundreds of acres of developable area. And we have untold buildings that are not in full use. And the topic, of course, now is the brewery that's coming in on 29 and 64. Why do we need to put it outside of the growth area? Why don't we put it inside the growth area? So, like most of these topics, you get the red herrings coming out where people who don't want to see it happen come up with their reasons why they don't want to see it happen. And some of them are legit and some of them are kind of odd. One of them is that they are hypothesized 5,000 trips per day. VDOT came up with that number, or said to have come up with that number. So I called some breweries on the West Coast, where they're very sensitive to traffic, and found that a brewery of about 350,000 barrels a year generates maybe, they thought, 150 trips a day. It's a long way from 5,000. And that generated some other questions. I hung up and I was sitting there saying, well, what else could be going on here? Do they have a tap room where the public comes and sits down, and how much traffic would that? So I called some tap rooms. They're talking about 200 or 300, you know, hundreds of trips a day for their success. We'll have it a bottling plant. None of these questions have been brought up or answered, by the way. So you make the beer, do you sell it by the keg, or do you bottle it up and put it in bottles, and does that generate truck traffic? So I called a plant that was a bottling plant from one of the major breweries and said, how many trips? You know, how many trucks? And they said, well, we got like 10, 12 trucks a day. This is for that 300, you know. So I said, well, maybe it's the yeast and the hops and the wheat and the barley and all the grains coming in. Nope, that's one or two trucks every week. It's just, I couldn't make the 5,000 number. So I would ask, if I were on the board, I'd ask for some resolution. In fact, I have a call in to the county development officer now to ask, where did that number come from? Because I look at that and say, until I can understand it better, I class it as a red herring. Then they've had, well, the bridge on 64 going over 29. Well, we all know for years that the exit ramp and the entrance ramp are substandard, and they are the same ramp. So everybody's been having trouble with that forever. And if you're going to put more truck traffic on it, it's going to have to be redone. I maintain that if you didn't do anything with the brewery, if you didn't do anything with the growth area, that's got to get redone. And it's going to cost the county, well, the state, some money. VDOT's going to have to come up with the cash for that. The interstate highway system designed it improperly to begin with. It's been a problem for decades. So I look at it and I say, well, that's another red herring. Yeah, it's a problem. It has to be fixed. It has nothing to do with the growth area. It's safety. So then they come up and they start talking about the why do we need this? And it's going to bring 100 jobs to Albemarle County. Those people aren't going to come. You know, the blue-collar workers there, as we talked earlier, the police and the firemen and all, they're not going to come from Albemarle County. They're going to come from Nelson County because it's just a little bit south. Are they going to come from Augusta over the mountain, from Waynesboro? Because even if they were new to the area, they would go to work in the brewery and go find a place to live that they could afford. And they're not going to pay the wages that are required to live a normal life inside the county. It's an expensive place to live. It's an expensive place to buy a house. It's an expensive place to, you know, have your children do their after-school activities. So I say, well, that's not going to provide, you know, a reason to build it. So then I pulled out a map and I started looking at where are the breweries. You know where the breweries are clustered? They're clustered in Seattle. They're clustered in Portland. They're based in Colorado. All these because the biggest component of brewing beer is water, and they have to have good water to brew good beer. And they need calcium and gypsum and all these other minerals that are endemic in the water for different types of beer, whether it be a pilsner or a stout, an IPA or what have you. So why Albemarle County? Well, if you look at the brew house, the beer house coming out of this county right now, it's pretty darn good. We have good water in this county. That land backs up to the Ragged Mountain Reservoir because the Ragged Mountain Reservoir has been extended under I-64. It comes right on the back. And, you know, there's some surrounding land that's owned by, I guess, Ravana Water and Sewer at this point. And then there's some Nature Conservancy land up there and so forth that isn't, you know, you don't have to go across it to get to this. But, and then the basic water in the town is filtered now with activated carbon. So, you know, we've got water. We've got proven water. It has to be reliable summer and winter, year after year, because you can't have a beer taste one way one day and then something else, you know, another day. And our water so far, unless we build this uphill pipeline, the uphill river, you know, from South Fork Reservoir to Ragged Mountain, where we're going to take that putrid water we were talking about earlier and pump it up and put it in that pristine water at Ragged Mountain, you know, it's pretty good for brewing beer. So I see that if we don't do that, then we've probably got a very good location, not just because of 64 and 29. We've got a good location for a brewery. And we've got a labor force. It might not be our labor force, but it's going to be coming from other areas. We'll receive the tax dollars off of it. Why do we have property tax and the business taxes? Why do we have the development area? We have the development area because we have to pay our bills. 2 years ago, we had a penny and a half increase on the sales tax. Last year, we had 2 cents. The Board of Supervisors now, quote, says we have substantial and growing deficits for the next 5 years. Why 5 years? That's the end of the study. Somehow we have got to either come up with more revenue or we're going to have to live a trimmer life. And I'm kind of in favor of coming up with more revenue. So if we have to put it south of 64 on 29, it's not a belching, well, let's talk about that because one of the byproducts of brewing beer is carbon dioxide. I don't think it's a problem, but I'm sure there's some people that will have overlooked the fact that it makes one heck of a lot of carbon dioxide. They'll mitigate it. They'll, you know, take it, compress it, and sell it. But it's a potential. So I'm kind of for it, and I'm for it because I don't want to trim away some of the quality of life that we have established in the county to make the budget work out. I don't want the budget people to come back and say, well, we can do it with increased debt load. That's just moving it to our children. Somebody's got to pay the bill sometime. And if we raise the taxes on the brewery itself, they'll go somewhere else. This poor gal, I say poor gal, she's a very fine gal that is running the economic development for the county, needs to create a story where Albemarle County welcomes business, encourages business to consider us. We need to attract businesses to this county. And if we come forth with all of these problems that are real and some of these problems that aren't so real and this intransigent nature where we're not going to expand things or make it accommodating, we won't get their time of day. And it's been so awful, that last meeting of the Planning Commission where they went from all for it to all against it for without even asking the questions of the client, doesn't build that goodwill. You know, Ingersoll Rand, we used to go out and have, you know, where do we put plants? Where do we expand plants? And we're looking for, you know, there's a team that goes out and evaluates. And if you're not on the list, you get scratched off the list. They're not coming back. After listening to that Planning Commission meeting, I'm surprised they're still in the hunt. Maybe they're gone and we don't know it and they're just looking for reasons to tell us that they're already gone. I don't know, but, we need to be a lot more receiving and accommodating to the businesses that are good for this county. And we need to generate the revenue or we're going to have to trim back our standards of living. That's enough.
Question number 7. Describe a part of local government that would benefit from increased cooperation by the city, county, and or the University of Virginia and that you would make a priority.
Well, I think in the recent years, the problems between the city and the University of Virginia and the county have been based upon abuse of women. I mean, we have women missing from the community entirely. We have, you know, murder. We have rape. We have all kinds of mayhem going on in this community that I know that members of my family look at UVA and they look at other options for their children and they say, well, UVA has been in the news so much. That's what their mindset is. it's probably, you know, not, it's probably, it's a very emotional and highly charged topic entirely. But I think we need to take these on as a, you know, as a community and realize that we have a Commonwealth's Attorney Office. And that Commonwealth's Attorney Office is responsible for everything in the Commonwealth, in the county, in the city, and in the university. And why that isn't the focal point or where it all comes together, I don't know. But your rights as a citizen are protected by the Commonwealth's Attorney. And if a girl is raped on campus of UVA, she's still under the purview of the Commonwealth's Attorney. And if a girl is or a guy is abducted or mistreated or whatever, that's the person that, to me, needs to come to the front. That's the person that we rely upon. And I haven't seen that happen. So I think that right now is probably one of the biggest sources of absolute disgust. Because you can't have murder in a community the size. Charlottesville's, what, 45,000 people? The county's 100,000, 110,000 people? These are not large populations, but look at what's happening here. It's in the news year after year after year, and we go through all this agony and angst. Why can't we just get our hands around what is a good law enforcement policy, and can't we get these cases resolved quickly and efficiently? And why do we have to have so much pain and suffering? So to me, that's number one on the city, county, and UVA relations. You get into the tax base, you get into the utilities and all of that. These are negotiations that can be, you know, handled by good men of good intent. But this whole thing about the criminality is just, to me, is over the top. I don't want it in my community, and I don't think anybody does. And the Commonwealth's Attorney is where I hold the accountability.
Question number 8. What improvements could be made to our community's placemaking efforts?
Placemaking. I think it was 3 years ago that a friend of a friend invited me to your holiday party. I sat behind Michael Bills, who is your fearless leader, and I think it was a young lady from the Knight organization gave a presentation on placemaking. It's the first time I'd really thought about that. And my thoughts, as I reflect back on that, my thoughts were Charlottesville had a time when placemaking, building places in the community that identified it, was kind of a standard affair. I mean, look at the library. It wasn't built out of frame construction. It's built out of brick and mortar and granite and limestone, I guess, would be it's solid. It's going to be there. It's been there for generations. It's going to be there for generations. Look at the Historical Society. McIntyre gave us McIntyre Park, and he gave us Lee Park, and he gave us what's the park that has Stonewall Jackson in it. We have Lane Auditorium was built to endure the ages. The Jefferson School is still there. It's not going anywhere. It's solid. Recently rehabbed using its original support, its original shell. But now when we build these new buildings, they seem to be coming out, and a lot of people deride the expense of the new buildings. And I'm thinking of the fire department that the city built on Fry Springs area. I have no problem with that. That fire department is going to be there. I've walked through it. It's going to be there for generations to come. And that's placemaking to me. And we got to get from these places, we have to have an infrastructure. We need to get from A to B. And I think there was one time there was even a trolley in Charlottesville. And now we have a wheeled trolley on rubber tires. So, you know, times move along, but the placemaking that's in place is the product of many generations, of several generations, I say. The country's 8 generations old, so it can't be so many. But now we are entering this era where placemaking is kind of like we're making this place on West Main Street called the Flats. Well, quite frankly, I don't think that construction is going to endure the ages. Some people absolutely loved it and staked their reputations on it, and as soon as it was complete, they said, oh, what a mistake. It shouldn't have ever been built. And the reframe of that whole deal was kind of a mystery unto itself. So placemaking is, you know, building upon what we already have, the place that I was born, the place that has been Charlottesville for years. Do we need to enhance it? Always. Each generation has to leave their additions on it. There's some talk now, I think the Zacos want to take down the statues. They're part of the place. Are we to erase the history and then be destined to relive it again? Or do we keep the history in place and look at the people who fought it? You know, the Civil War is what I'm speaking of. And say they were good and they were bad. They were human beings. They were, you know, they had some good qualities and they had some bad qualities. But we need the real history. We don't need history to be rewritten to suit somebody's dream of what the place is. The place is what it is, and I admire those historians who can go back and back up their work in fact, historical fact. I hate these historians that want to rewrite history and interpret the facts that they can hang around a narrative that has nothing to do with the reality of the situation. And you look at it and you say, this is, what was that, redirect your thinking. So I think placemaking is very important, and I think that placemaking needs to be expensive. It doesn't need to be expensive, but I think it is expensive, endemic. It's part of the nature of it. And I think that building good public structures that endure the ages is part of the placemaking effort.
You mentioned a couple of names, and just for the listeners, Michael Bills was our co-founder of Charlottesville Tomorrow. He's not on our board of directors today, but he was for many years. And then I think you mentioned Zacos, Kristen Zacos, city councilor.
Well, the two Zacos. It's Kristen Zacos, city councilor, and then there's her husband,
Joe Zacos,
mm-hmm. who is with Organizing Virginia. Virginia Organizing,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Okay. And in with respect to the statues, did you mean Kristen Zacos, the city councilor?
She's been very outspoken about taking down the Lee and the Stonewall Jackson statues.
Okay. I just want to make sure that was clear. Question number 9. How would you describe the challenges and opportunities facing Albemarle County's rural farms, fields, and forests?
We are blessed to live in a drop-dead gorgeous place. This place is the product of many families and in many cases, generations of those families taking care of the rural area. If you drive out 22-231, if you drive out Barracks Road, you're going to see some of the most beautiful scenery in America. I love for my extended family from Oklahoma and Seattle to come and visit because they look around and they say, this is just drop-dead gorgeous. Environmentally, we need to do the right thing. And we need to create a model community that our founders would be very pleased with, very proud of. And it's a heck of a job to come up with how do we preserve the past and build for the next generation. There are people that want to keep the population fixed. Well, the population of Americans is, you know, reproducing at less than 2.0. That means that we're not replacing ourselves. A husband and a wife need 2 children to replace themselves, and on the averages we're producing, what is it, not 1.95 or something like that. We're slightly under 2.0. We're not replacing ourselves. But we're bringing your people into this area from other countries, and quite frankly, it's the kindest population you'll ever encounter. Going door to door, I've met so many wonderful people. The world is in turmoil. And there are disasters and horrible things happening. People being beheaded and killed and populations immigrating to their neighbors. And it's just a horrible world that we live in. And many of them look to the U.S. to come here. The IRC is bringing into the city of Charlottesville 200 families every year. The county's getting 188 families every year. And that puts a load. Where do those people live? How do we support them? It costs a fortune to take a family that is brand new. They could be wonderful people, but they don't speak the language. They don't share the culture. They haven't had the health care benefits that we've had. They haven't had the educational benefits that we have. And to make them comfortable in this community requires that the community receive them and really put out a lot of blood, sweat, tears, and money to make it happen, and we do it. And that's admirable. It's admirable. Have no problems with that at all. But it comes with a cost. And we really need to come up with how many people can we absorb? Because quite frankly, you could empty out Dakar, and Charlottesville is 45,000 people. The county is 100, 120,000 people in total. That's men, women, and children. There's a limit to what our goodwill can handle. And I really think that the Board of Supervisors on the county side needs to say, this is what we can afford to do. Now, how does that get back to the rural areas in the county? Well, when you fill up the development areas, you've got to invade the rural areas. You've also got to pay for these families. Your family doesn't cost as much per year as taking a family from zero up to subsistence level where they can support themselves. We have to take them through the healthcare system. We have to take them through the educational system. We have to teach them the language. We have to teach them the culture. We have to provide housing for them until they can get the income to where they can afford their own housing. We have to provide them food until they have the income to where they can provide their own food. In all these things, it's very, very expensive. And how do we pay for it? We have to have taxes. The schools pick up their load. Well, they have to. They can't do it on air. They need money to pick up that load. And that, unfortunately, is falling more and more toward the rural areas who have lived with very low taxes. So I think taxes are a threat to having to break up these large tracts of land that families have been able to preserve for years. And I'd like to see these families have the same rights for the next generation that their parents who own the farms now have. I think that they should be kept intact. They're our parks. They're our treasure. They are, you know, preserving the beauty of this beautiful place. So that's one issue. Water is another one. We talked about it earlier. The right for the government to come onto a farm and say that seasonal stream is under our control and it's substandard and you're going to, Mr. Farmer, fix it. But he'll say, I sold my land into a conservation easement. Guess what? He's not making any money. The farmers in the Albemarle County are not that profitable, if profitable at all. A lot of them have natural, family money that they can use to live a lifestyle. But many of them are farmers. They have cattle. They raise crops. And they try to make an ends meet off of this. Well, you can't look at these remediation methods and put them on top of a money-losing farm and expect the farmer not to say, well, I need to sell off the land. Well, he can't because it's in a conservation easement. You know who's making money off of that farm? They're selling carbon credits. The guys that own the conservation easements are selling the carbon. Trichard was the president of the Nature Conservancy, and he went in front of the Detroit Economic Forum and said, the big three automakers need to partner with the Nature Conservancy because they need to buy tax credits, and we've got more tax credits because we own more land than any other entity. We own more land than the National Park Service, and we've got tax credit, carbon credits for sale. They need to partner with us. Well, if they're making the money, why don't they pay some of the mitigation? Why don't they pay to keep the farmers farming? Because the farmers are now limited in what they can do to pay the, you know, the credits. So they have no cost. You know, I use the Nature Conservancy as a model, but, you know, they didn't pay their money in large for the land. It was either given to them or it was bought with tax credits, which the people of Virginia paid. So they've got this land that they're selling tax carbon credits off of with a zero investment. You know, that's pure income. And the last, of course, is the control issue. When these families have controlled and kept their, you know, 400 acres together, then why do we need to come onto their land and say that the state has the right to control its use and sale? The state has a right to control the mandates that are put upon it for stormwater or for anything else. There needs to be some ownership of private land. There needs to be some private control of your land, the right to quietly and peacefully enjoy your land. So that's why I feel about the rural area. I think we need to keep the taxes down. We need to keep the the government out of the control of it, not entirely, but largely. And I think that we need to make sure that we all continue to enjoy this beautiful place that we live in.
Question number 10. What is your top transportation priority, and how will it be funded?
We grew up in an era when the car became prevalent. I think more and more the car companies are finding out that, you know, you have the spending wave. You know, when you're very young, you don't spend much money. You don't have a car. And I'm going to take the money as one issue because people can relate to it, but look at how many cars you control. A friend of mine told me once that success was how many pots do you control. So you're young, you're born, you don't spend very much. You get into grammar school and you spend a little bit more and you got some clothing and shoes and so forth. You get into high school, you spend more because now you've got style and all these things going on. And the end of high school, you get your car. And you go off to college and you spend even more. And your parents now are getting into that, they've gone through their family creation, their houses have gotten bigger and bigger, and then you go off to college and their houses get smaller and smaller. And instead of having three cars in the family, they go down to two cars. Then you get married and your spending becomes all-time maximum. What is that, age 39 or so? It's when you have your children and they're all going to school, and your parents' spending is, you know, their spending wave is way behind because now they're going through downsizing their houses and they're down to one car and they're getting older and so forth. Well, the baby boomers are all on the downside right now. So the demand for cars is down, and there's no doubt that, you know, GM, Ford, and Chrysler are not, you know, seeing the successes that they saw in the past. And it's because of the baby boomer generation is so much larger, multiples than their children, the echo boomers. So I look at transportation, and I just hope that we're not using the numbers of the past to plan the future transportation, because it's different these days. Cars are not as big to begin with, and they don't burn as much fuel. There are not as many of them largely, but we still have these pinch points. So what is Charlottesville? Charlottesville is a transportation hub for Central Virginia. We have the airport. We have the train station. We have 64. We have 29. And we can't move any of them. They're fixed. And we need to get to all of them. We are the medical center. We have the hospitals for Central Virginia. We're the medical center for Central Virginia. We've got to get people in and out, not just on an emergency basis, but to see their doctors. We need a good, solid transportation plan. We moved Martha Jefferson, but nobody thought about changing a single road. I live in Pantop, and I can tell you, if I'm downtown and want to get to Pantop at 5 o'clock, I'm in for a wait. So what happens is we look at these intersections, and they do traffic plans for intersections, for God's sakes. Why don't we get a regional transportation plan put together, a really good current one, and then take that regional plan and start to zero in on different draws, and we can see what the important ones are. You know, we need to get people to the hospital. They got this traffic conflagration at a particular intersection. We've got through traffic, and we've got local traffic. And how are we going to handle that locally? But we can't do that intersection by intersection. We've got to do it regionally and then come inward. And I have not seen a regional traffic plan put forward. And that is number one. I don't know if you can prioritize anything until you have the regional study done, and done by very good people. You know, you can get a low rate, cut rate plan or study. You can go hire a couple of graduate students from Virginia Tech, and they'll give you a pretty damn good plan. Or you can go out and find people who have experience, who have track record, who have education, and get them to put together, and they'll have a company that does it, and we'll get a very good plan. This fellow, Ian Lockwood, is very talented and very experienced, and he carries the credentials that no city councilor, that no supervisor could possibly come close to.
And our last question, number 11, what areas of the current comprehensive plan will you concentrate on for implementation, improvement, and or monitoring?
The comprehensive plan. I recently made a big tragic mistake. I pulled up the comprehensive plan on my computer, and I set the computer to print it all out. All chapters. Now, the mistake was I didn't put it two-sided, single-sided. Do you know how many pages are in the comprehensive plan? On the desk beside me is a ream of paper. It took a ream and a half to print it out in small font. It is extremely comprehensive. It's detailed to a fault. And it seems to have the basis of it being the global warming initiatives, the ICLEI initiatives, and the, what was that other third thing, Agenda 21, was it? Initiatives built within it. It's all of those reinstated in the comprehensive plan. And I don't know if that was intentional or whether that was just happenstance. It's the way it worked out because of the people that were behind the creation of the comprehensive plan. I look at other counties' comprehensive plans. Goochland, for instance. It's a fraction as thick. It's something that a citizen can pick up and read and understand. But to give them 700 and some pages of comprehensive plan is just not fair. I mean, it's way over the top, in my opinion. So I would encourage us to sit down and say, what is it that gives us a plan? And then there was this talk about it. It's only a guide. It's only a guide. All through these torturous years of going through it chapter by chapter by chapter, it was referred to. It's only a guide. Pass that. Let it go. It's only a guide. Now we've got people in the Planning Commission saying it is, quote, sacrosanct. Well, you can't treat it like a law. It hasn't been codified. And when the Planning Commission says it's sacrosanct, that just offends me. Now, the Planning Commission seems to be the ones that come up with yay or nay, or we can go or we can't go, but they're supposed to look at the plan, at the development of the county and comment and oversee, not have yay or nay capabilities. They're supposed to be advisors, but they seem to see themselves as the gatekeepers. And they use the comprehensive plan as their body of law, not their guide. So I think the comprehensive plan needs to be something that's reworked yet again, more in lines of it being an advisory plan for an advisory body. And to comment on any portion of the 700 and some pages, to me is, I've read maybe 300 pages of it, and I'll get through all 750, but or 760, or whatever it turned out to be. But I'm only up to like 300, so I'll reserve comment on any section for later. I noticed that it took the Board of Supervisors over a year to get through the, how many years? We were 3 years in the manufacturing and review of the comprehensive plan. I can't do you justice today.
Richard Lloyd, thank you for participating in this interview with Charlottesville Tomorrow.